From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashba. And this is On Point. This week, President Trump complained of being treated badly as the Justice Department appointed a special counsel to investigate his campaign and Russia.
The entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi had no sympathy for Trump over how he's being treated.
We're talking frivolous now here in terms of what he says about how he characterizes any legitimate question about his outrageous and potentially dangerous behavior.
And Senator John McCain said the crisis in the White House has hit a new benchmark.
We've seen this movie before. I think it's reaching the point where it's of Watergate size and scale.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John Harward, Kathy Gilsonen, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What's your take on the appointment of special counsel Robert Mueller? Is this a witch hunt, as President Trump tweets? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from Washington is John Harward, editor-at-large for CNBC. John, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Well, I know it's been a great busy week for you, John, so thanks for sneaking over to NPR or to join us here. Also with us from Washington is Kathy Gilsonen, senior editor at The Atlantic, where she oversees the global section. Kathy, welcome to you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kathy, and John.
Okay. So, John, we have to begin with so many extraordinary stories, but my attention has been caught by this above-the-fold front-page story in the New York Times today, Comey wanted president kept at a distance. A really extraordinary story here of a relationship that has gone south in the last month or so.
Well, it seems to have gone south from the very beginning, and we can understand in this story today why James Comey was so anxious, because earlier in the week we learned, also from the New York Times, that James Comey in contemporaneous notes had said in one meeting in February the president asked him to quell, back off of the investigation of Michael Flynn, his at that time ex-national security advisor. And so Donald Trump is somebody who breaks all normal ways of behaving for major politicians. And James Comey happens to have a very high concern about ethical appearances, and it's no wonder that he decided to be very, very careful in dealing with the president, and that ended up getting him fired.
And we heard actually from a friend, a quoted source, Ben Wittes from Lawfare, a friend of Jim Comey, who said that Comey shared with him his extraordinary discomfort at even being in the same room with the president. Really, that's an amazing story.
It's really incredible that we're talking here about a president of the United States. We've said that countless times since President Trump took office. The way he talks, his approach to governance, the things that he considers important and the things that he doesn't. But we're in uncharted territory here, and there's a possibility that it could threaten his survival for 4 years in office.
Yeah, we'll see about that. Meanwhile, during a press conference with President Juan Manuel Santos of Colombia yesterday, President Trump said he thought his decision to fire FBI Director James Comey would be broadly supported.
Director Comey was very unpopular with most people. I actually thought when I made that decision, and I also got a very, very strong recommendation, as you know, from the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein. But when I made that decision, I actually thought that it would be a bipartisan decision, because you look at all of the people on the Democratic side, not only the Republican side, that were saying such terrible things about Director Comey.
Well, Jack Beatty, meanwhile, Jim Comey is gone, but President Trump now has Robert Mueller to deal with as a special counsel. And the truth, we understand, is that Robert Mueller and Jim Comey actually are longtime friends, have a lot of respect for each other. So what do you think? Is President Trump better off with Robert Mueller on his going after him as opposed to Jim Comey?
Not at all. You know, in that respect, it's backfired. It's worse because, of course, it's now open and out there, and we know why Mueller was appointed, because of the president's efforts to ingratiate himself, to somehow influence Mr. Comey. If he tries that with Mueller, well, there's just going to be no end of trouble. You know, when you look at the differences in the men, and someone went back and looked at what they were doing in 1968, Mueller was volunteering for the Marine Corps in the worst year of the Vietnam War, just when Mr. Trump, as he wrote, as said sometime before, you know, was struggling, trying to keep away venereal disease. So we have a man of integrity in Mueller, a straight arrow against a man of the dodgiest character who's ever been in the White House. It is quite a contrast of personalities.
Meanwhile, there's so much to discuss here, and Kathy Gilson, and we can't go too far into this program without mentioning the big story that led off this week, which was the news that President Trump had shared classified intelligence with the Russians during a meeting with the Russian ambassador and the Russian foreign minister. Let's first hear what National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster told reporters on Tuesday, saying that President Trump did not act unethically in sharing that classified information with Russian officials.
What the president discussed with the foreign minister was wholly appropriate to that conversation and is consistent with the routine sharing of information between the president and any leaders with whom he's engaged.
So, Kathy, this was the news, the first big news of this week. And in spite of what General McMaster says, and he's, of course, a very widely respected figure in the military, that argument did not go over very well, did it?
No, it did not. And I think it was pointed out frequently that McMaster's statement was very carefully worded. The original story broke in the Washington Post and said that Trump had shared this information with the Russian foreign minister and the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, who's the guy who Michael Flynn got in trouble for meeting with. But basically the report said that Trump had shared classified information and that this was seen as serious enough by people in the room that they immediately called the CIA, the NSA, started doing damage control about it. What McMaster said in his denial was that Trump had not revealed sources and methods, which was not actually something that the Washington Post had reported. The other thing to keep in mind, of course, is that having now fired the FBI director and having repeatedly cast aspersions on the intelligence community through the campaign and, you know, calling their investigations a witch hunt and comparing the CIA to Nazi Germany. You know, this is a president that has a very strained relationship with his own intelligence community. I don't think that this particular revelation is helpful. And I also don't think that in light of his upcoming foreign trip, that this is a report that's going to be ignored by leaders in foreign capitals who are now wondering whether what they tell Trump is going to go immediately back to the Russians.
So, John Horowitz, three huge stories. One, the leak of classified intelligence to the Russians, which we were just discussing. Two, the news that FBI Director Jim Comey, after meeting with President Trump, wrote a memo in which he said President Trump had asked him to back off in the investigation of General Flynn. And then the appointment of a special counsel, Robert Mueller. So, at the end of this week, John, where does President Trump stand most of all with Republicans in Congress? How has this week shifted their attitude toward his presidency, if it has?
The president remains very strong, or reasonably strong, I should say, among the Republican base. In most recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll, he had the support of about 82% of ordinary Republicans. That means that it's difficult for Republicans in Congress to run away from him. However, the ground has been softening underneath Trump for a while. Series of controversies, poor management of the White House, inept leadership that the president has displayed. So we saw further evidence of that softening. And one thing we know is that there comes a point where weak support can end up collapsing if people lose faith in a president and come to believe that the president is going to endanger their own careers. That, of course, that happened with Richard Nixon at the end of Watergate. And I do think the most important element of the three stories that you mentioned, when you talk about the sharing of intelligence with the Russians, you could chalk that up, and I imagine that the White House, inside the White House, that's what they're doing, to a combination of sloppiness and ignorance. On the other hand, the issue with Comey and the account of their meeting, that's a question of honesty and credibility. And this president has very weak credibility. In our poll, 25% of the American people say they have a high opinion of his honesty. That makes for a very difficult go for the president when he has a public argument with Jim Comey over whether he did something. And Bob Mueller, who is a former ally of James Comey in the U.S. government, it is hard to imagine him believing President Trump's version of a given event over a conflicting account from James Comey.
And Jack Beatty, now President Trump is off, starting a foreign trip, a 9-day foreign trip that's going to take him through some very important capitals. And, you know, one has to wonder, is he happy to be out of the country or a little nervous to be out of the country?
Yes. And are they going to be happy to have him out of the country? I mean, he's going to the Vatican to take it from the end where he's insulted the Pope. He's going to Israel where he's divulged the secret Israel had about their source. And he's going to Saudi Arabia. And of course, he ran on a sort of anti-Muslim platform. So, yes, it's going to be an interesting trip.
And this is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. What do you make of ousted FBI Director James Comey's memo of President Trump's itinerary on his first trip abroad? With me this hour are John Harwood, Kathy Gilsonen, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And Frank is also with us. He's on the line from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Frank, thanks for calling On Point. You're on the air. Frank, are you there?
Okay. Tom, are you there?
Yes, Frank.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
Hi. So I want to talk about the president's trip coming up. Listen, I personally am not a huge fan of the president, but I know that everywhere he goes, he's going to have to stand for an account for the things that he said on the campaign trail. First up is Saudi Arabia, where he's going to deal with the large Muslim population, where very clearly he wanted to ban Muslims from our country. Secondly, he's going to go to Brussels and have to deal with NATO, an organization he said was obsolete. Listen, our president is too quick to say one thing and then go around and flip right back. And that's what's embarrassing. Listen, I'm embarrassed and I'm disappointed with our president. And I'm not looking forward to how America is going to be represented on this trip.
Okay, Kathy Gilson, and let me just play devil's advocate a little bit here. There are a lot of leaders on this trip that say they're eager to meet with President Trump, right?
I'm sure they are. I think that one consistent element of Trump's meetings with foreign leaders, to include Xi Jinping and Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov from Russia, a lot of these foreign leaders have gotten concessions out of Trump. There is a sense among some that the personal meeting with Trump is a way to really establish a relationship and sort of get things out of him. I do. I agree with Frank that there's probably a risk to Trump's first overseas trip, given some of the things he's said about Muslims, about NATO. I think that H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, earlier this week at a press conference, used the word reaffirm a lot of times, which to me suggests that Trump or at least his team recognizes that some of this trip is about damage control. You know, Obama got criticized a lot for so-called apology tours, but I think in a very real sense, Trump is going to have to explain what he said before. On the other hand, though, I don't think Saudi Arabia, in particular, the leaders of Saudi Arabia, have been particularly bothered by the travel ban, which did not include Saudi Arabia, first of all. Secondly, they were disappointed with many of the policies of the Obama administration, and in particular, it's seeming to lean toward Iran with the Iran nuclear deal. I think they are excited for new blood in the White House, but we will see how Trump's speech on Islam and the birthplace of Islam goes over.
Well, yeah, of course, that's a big question. On the other hand, we have seen John Harwood's pretty extraordinary preparations on the Saudi side, really laying out the red carpet for this president in a way they haven't done for previous presidents.
Well, I think Kathy's point is exactly the right one. What foreign leaders have seen, and what we've seen here in the United States domestically as well, is that Donald Trump offers a lot of bluster, but when you actually get one-on-one with him, he sometimes will back off. And so the more you lay it on thick for Donald Trump, the better your chances. Remember, he talked about China as raping the United States economically during the campaign, said he was going to get tough, and said he was going to crack down on currency manipulation. He said he was going to get them to very quickly put pressure, decisive pressure on North Korea on its nuclear program. And he met with Xi Jinping in Mar-a-Lago, and he came out and said, wow, I thought it was so easy, but after 10 minutes, I realized it wasn't so easy. That's the kind of thing that foreign leaders love to be able to do.
Yeah. Let's hear now from President Trump himself about what his agenda is on this trip, speaking about it Wednesday during his commencement address at the Coast Guard Academy. He said he's only looking for partners who will contribute.
I will strengthen old friendships and will seek new partners, but partners who also help us, not partners who take and take and take. Partners who help, and partners who help pay for whatever we are doing and all of the good we're doing for them, which is something that a lot of people have not gotten used to, and they just can't get used to it. I say, get used to it, folks.
Jack Meaney, we're seeing here some interesting changes between President Trump's relations with foreign leaders and his predecessors. One thing that seems to stand out is that President Trump has really downgraded the concern over human rights that President Obama showed, and even President Bush before him. And we saw that this week, didn't we, when the Turkish president was in town. President Erdogan has led a real intense crackdown on his opposition. And even while he was here in town in the United States, his own bodyguards went after opposition demonstrators. And we didn't hear anything from the White House about that human rights performance.
Yes. And John McCain said, throw the ambassador out. Throw that Turkish ambassador out.
Right.
This is an affront to American institutions, to freedom of speech. Yes, the president is. And of course, with Turkey, you always have to go back to the Trump business interests. He has a tower or two towers or buildings in any event in Istanbul. And does that qualify his relationship with Turkey? That's part of the whole emoluments clause violation cloud that hangs over him, which is quite separate from Russia, but in its way just as disturbing.
Well, Kathy, it's important. You know, I cover religion at NPR, and one of the things that I find really impressive, actually, about this trip is that President Trump is starting out with by visiting the homelands of the three major monotheistic faiths, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. And in his White House press briefing last Friday, National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster called attention to this focus of the trip.
This trip is truly historic. No president has ever visited the homelands and holy sites of the Jewish, Christian, and Muslim faiths all on one trip. And what President Trump is seeking is to unite peoples of all faiths around a common vision of peace, progress, and prosperity. He will bring a message of tolerance and of hope to billions.
Well, Kathy, you mentioned before he's going to be giving a speech on Islam in Saudi Arabia. We have seen reports that this speech will have been written, at least in large part, by Stephen Miller, who is known to have advanced some of the more extreme anti-Muslim or anti-Islam statements that President Trump has made.
Right. And I think that that particular speech may benefit from low expectations. I think that on the other hand, though, and what McMaster is describing is a staggeringly ambitious goal, particularly for this specific president, who is not an especially overtly religious person, certainly much less so than any president in recent memory. And I think that the goal of uniting people of all three faiths around a common vision of peace is one that I worry we're going to be disappointed with. And the question, McMaster said that the speech is intended to unite the broader Muslim world against common enemies of all civilization and to demonstrate America's commitment to our Muslim partners. This is an interesting framing and an interesting semi-shift from Trump, who began who very famously waged much of his campaign pronouncing the words radical Islamic terrorism. He is seeming to acknowledge more and more, perhaps under McMaster's influence, that Muslims in fact have a role to play. However, you know, the drafting of the speech, there's just a lot of questions about what this speech is actually going to say. It's hard to make a speech about a religion that you're familiar with. I mean, if you can imagine Trump making a speech about Christianity, it would be a complex topic. This is a speech about a much more complicated subject for an American president to make, and many presidents have not been very successful with it. So we'll see what happens.
Tom?
Well, yes, Jack.
No, it's John.
Oh, John, sorry.
I know this is a show where you ask us the questions, but since you cover religion, I would love to know your view of what the pitfalls, if any, of delivering this speech on Islam are.
Yes, I second that question.
Well, people who take their faith seriously take it really seriously, and they will be parsing every word he says when he speaks about Islam, or if speaking about Judaism, or in Rome speaking about Catholicism. He's wading into some deep waters here, I'm hosting, so I'm not going to be offering my opinion about this. President Trump says that, he wants to promote a message of tolerance, or at least his advisors say that's what he wants to promote. But he tweeted this morning, getting ready for my big foreign trip, will be strongly protecting American interests. That's what I like to do. So even though he's heading out on this trip, he's going to be protecting American interests. And Jack, we actually heard that he's not entirely comfortable about a 9-day trip. I mean, he's very comfortable here in the United States protecting American interests. It's going to be interesting to see how comfortable he is 9 days out of the country.
Yes, it's not for nothing that he's pretty much stayed where he was and where he's been, and then Florida, and now he's abroad. This is an entirely alien experience for him, I think. I mean, certainly he's traveled. And I think he's probably, with all this talk of religion, I just think that's the cant of this business. I think what he really can probably even perhaps be good at is just the sort of mercantile bargaining that is his specialty, where he can say to, the NATO people, well, can you give me a little more spending on your defense? Where he can say to Saudi Arabia, what's your give for this? That's what his MO is. I'm supposed to be the guy who's good at that. Let's see if he can come back with a few bargains for America.
And that's Jack Beatty, our news analyst. I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. And let's go now to Justin, who is on the line from Texas. Justin, I assume you've been following this discussion on the program so far. What are your thoughts?
Well, I just had a couple of comments. I'm 43 years old. I have, you know, been through a few presidents that I can remember. And I don't think you guys have criticized, scrutinized, or been so biased against any one man in my memory. Obama could have run over and killed somebody, and y'all wouldn't even cover it. Y'all have just flipped as soon as this man was elected president. I think he's doing a great job. He's not perfect. He's had some screw-ups here and there, but geez Louise, nobody's even given him a chance. Y'all have just cut him off at the knees every chance y'all get. It's unreal. It's unfathomable how y'all have just shredded him. Y'all didn't give Clinton this much deal when he had his little fling in the White House. It's unreal.
Okay, Justin, let me just ask you a couple of questions just to clarify. First of all, what was your reaction to the news that the president had shared classified intelligence with the Russians? And second, what did you think of the news that Jim Comey, the FBI director, wrote a memo in which he said that President Trump had urged him to back off his investigation of General Flynn?
Well, the deal with the Comey memo, what's the problem with one man asking another man to, hey, do something? That is not obstruction.
It is the president of the United States.
Correct. He can do whatever the hell he wants, just about. But and as far as the sharing classified info, the press has gotten so comfortable with being, you know, Obama just let them in everywhere. And, you know, who knows what the truth is on some of y'all's reporting. If he shared a little info, big deal. To my knowledge and to what McMaster said, nothing was inappropriate.
Okay, so, Justin, thanks very much. What's the big deal? John Harwood, it is true that we have we've seen a really adversarial relationship between the news media and this White House, the likes of which it's hard to imagine a precedent for that. That's indisputable, is it not?
Yes, but the lack of precedent flows from the behavior of President Trump. We haven't had a president before who so brazenly says things that are not true, transparently is unfamiliar with his own policies, makes stuff up in the moment. That we just haven't seen that. And, you know, we were talking before about Henry McMaster and saying the president's goal is to bring people together. I recognize that White House advisors believe that that's the kind of thing a president should aspire to do, but there is zero evidence that that's what President Trump aspires to do. He hasn't done it in any realm of governance since he took office. So, yes, the press has taken on a different tone toward President Trump than others, but that's because he is so far outside of norms of behavior that we've come to expect of the president of our country and the leader of the free world.
Well, and it's not only the news media that has a new relationship with this president. Republicans in Congress have been really quite extraordinarily critical of him for a president of their own party. Let's listen to what Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, said about the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel. He's concerned about the investigation into allegations that Trump's campaign collaborated with Russia. Here he is.
I respect the decision. Mueller's a good guy, but one of the big losers here is the public, because we're not going to hear from Comey now, most likely. I hope we do. I want to hear about the conversation. I want to know the context of it. But now that you have a special counsel, maybe that's off the table.
And that is Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, talking about his agenda and that of many people in Congress, which is that they have their own investigations, they have their own questions that they want answered, and there is a little concern that the appointment of Robert Mueller now will mean that those investigations on Capitol Hill might be slowing down. We're discussing the week in the news. You can join our conversation. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, as we mentioned, protests outside the Turkish embassy in Washington turned violent while Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was visiting. A bloodied protester was asked who attacked him.
Who attacked you?
The Turks. The Turks attacked me. The Turks attacked me.
Roger Ailes, the man who built Fox News into a cable news powerhouse, died at 77. He resigned the company last year amid charges of sexual harassment. Here he is in a 1996 interview.
We'd like to be premier journalists. We'd like to restore objectivity where we find it lacking.
And Chris Cornell, founder and frontman of the grunge rock band Soundgarden, dead at 52. His 1994 song, Black Hole Sun, was on an album that went platinum. Black Hole Sun, won't you come? Wash away the rain. Black Hole Sun, won't you come? Won't you come? You can join the conversation. How did Roger Ailes change American media and news coverage? What do you make of the dropped charges against Julian Assange? John Harward, Kathy Gilsonen, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty are with me this hour. Jack Beatty, first of all, your thoughts about the passing of Roger Ailes and how he changed American news broadcasting.
Well, I had a sort of microcosmic look at Mr. Ailes's monument last night. I watched Sean Hannity, and Hannity presented what really was the Ailes worldview and Justin's worldview. He presented a picture of a president who was being assailed by five different sources, the Democrats, establishment Republicans, the media, and the deep state. And they were all working to undo this man who'd had a mandate to change the Washington, and this was a terrible thing, and it was a vast conspiracy. And that's a fact. That Fox News, you could call it propaganda, you could call it spin, you could call it alternative facts. But that has a great hold on a large slice of the electorate. And if that's their aperture into reality, it's not likely Republicans are going to move toward holding Mr. Trump more accountable, because people are accepting that Ailes worldview, that picture there of a conspiracy against someone who's fighting for the forgotten American. They accept that as truth. And Ailes had a gift for that. He didn't make Trump, but as someone said, he made the conditions that made him resentment, the sense that the establishment was simply against ordinary Americans.
Well, that's certainly legitimate as a political critique. But, we had Brian Stelter on this program yesterday, the media analyst for CNN, who pointed out that Roger Ailes was actually a genius where television is concerned. And Brian talked about how he had personally learned from Roger Ailes how to be better on television. John Harward, you're a former print reporter, New York Times, who now is mostly on television. What are your thoughts about Roger Ailes strictly from a broadcasting point of view?
Well, he created a juggernaut that was founded in a political strategy, but he did a terrific job at honing in on his targets, and which is basically older conservatives, men in particular, and making that work. And I would point out that you know, he came out of politics. He spoke for people through the Nixon campaign who were pitted against the elites. You know, Richard Nixon himself was somebody who felt he was pitted against the elites. The difference between then and now is that the people that he was targeting once were a natural majority of the country, and now they're not. And as they have shrunk, as the nature of the country has changed, and white conservatives are a smaller and smaller portion of the country, they have felt more anxious about their place in the country, and that makes them more intensely loyal to people who speak for them. That's one way in which he contributed to Donald Trump, in which he built that loyal audience, is people who he catered to their sense of feeling besieged by forces in a changing country, and that worked politically, and it worked as a matter of television.
And Kathy Gilsonen, I don't want to slide. We have so much news to cover. I don't want to slide by some of the important international stories that we are seeing even today. Julian Assange no longer facing rape charges in Sweden. Does that mean that he is now free to leave the Ecuadorian embassy in London? And what do you think will happen if he does so?
I think the UK police will arrest him if he does so. If somehow he manages to make it back to Sweden, the statute of limitations is not up. He could be recharged at any time. So I think that there's the reasoning behind dropping the attempt to charge him was less about the status of the investigation than it was about the difficulty of actually digging into this with him holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy. So in that sense, he semi-succeeded, but it's a Pyrrhic victory because it doesn't really mean much in terms of his actual ability to move around.
Meanwhile, Kathy, the other big story, international story today, are elections in Iran. I saw some tweets earlier suggesting that there are very long lines at voting places in Iran. What's at stake in this election in Iran?
So more and less than meets the eye, I think. On the one hand, you know, the supreme leader controls the country. He is not elected. He vets the candidates for office. And so debate takes place within a narrow range of acceptability that the supreme leader himself has set. And he said himself, you know, no matter who wins this election, the real victor is the Islamic Republic, which tells you something about the nature of democratic competition. On the other hand, though, it's true that Iranians turn out to vote, and to some extent, this election pits two forces in society against each other, which is to say, you know, the vibrant democratic impulses among many of Iran's people who want to be free and modern and use technology and you know, have fun, and then there are these elements in society that are strongly conservative. And those strains are roughly represented in the two candidates, the incumbent Hassan Rouhani, who negotiated with the West the nuclear deal, and his challenger, Ebrahim Raisi, who is a cleric and who is implicated in some of the crimes of the Islamic Republic dating back to the 80s. So the question then, for me, the question really becomes not only, you know, we don't have good polling there. Some pollsters indicate that Rouhani is favored to win, but regime allied pollsters indicate that yeah. Raisi is favored. And so what you might see again is a disputed election result, yeah. which then that would not be a victory for the regime of the Islamic Republic. So that's something to watch. But in general, it's seen as sort of a referendum on this nuclear deal that Rouhani negotiated with the Obama administration.
Here's another thought from one of our listeners, Ellen, on our website. She's connecting the Saudi trip with the elections in Iran. She notes that we're going to be selling Riyadh anti-missile technology. And of course, Saudi Arabia and Iran are arch enemies. So who knows how that might change the dynamic. Let's go now back to the phones. Steve is on the line from Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, you are on point.
Tom, thanks. I'd like to return to the investigations, Mueller, Comey, the congressional stuff with a twist, and that is Mike Pence's culpability and possibly as a target. In all this, he was the head of the transition. Things are leaking out about, you know, the what did he know and when did he know it about Flynn. Is he part of a cover-up about Flynn, part of complicity with Trump about, you know, moving Flynn forward, about other Russian involvement with Manafort and some of those others? And he's also tied in because he's next in line in succession if something were to happen with Trump not continuing as president.
John Harwood, Vice President Pence hasn't really been very public this week, has he?
He hasn't, and it's not hard to imagine why, because he has been repeatedly embarrassed by the ways in which statements that he has made have been undercut by what we've learned since about Donald Trump and about the Trump White House operation. Now, some people wonder, was on, say, on the firing of James Comey or on the issue of whether or not the transition was informed about Michael Flynn and lobbying for Turkey, was he saying things – he was saying things that were untrue. But did he know that they were untrue, or had he been misled himself? We don't know the answer to those questions, and unfortunately for President Trump, not only his own credibility, but the credibility of his closest aides and advisors, including Mike Pence, have been shredded by the repeated back and forth. And I think Mike Pence has decided this week to try to protect himself a little bit.
Well, among Republicans, Vice President Pence is probably not alone in feeling somewhat uncomfortable these days. Let's consider what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said this week about the impact of these allegations and what that means for the Republican agenda in Congress.
I think we could do with a little less drama from the White House on a lot of things so that we can focus on our agenda, which is deregulations, tax reform, repealing and replacing Obamacare.
And that's Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point. Jack Beatty, what do you think this all means for the advancement of health care legislation, tax reform legislation, deregulations, all these things that Senator McConnell is talking about? Those are very important to Republicans in Capitol Hill.
They are, and it'll be interesting to see whether Congress is able to proceed on its own on these things, or how much help they're going to call on from the administration. You know, John Farrell, just written a big biography of Richard Nixon, was talking about what happens with a scandal like this, the Watergate being the only comp here. And he said above the White House staff and everybody, they all are caught up in the vortex. The White House is going to be completely caught up in the vortex of this investigation, and whether that will leave any connection, meaningful connection with Congress, whether that will impede what Congress wants to do, whether there will be these continual interruptions as patriotic people on the one hand or deep state leakers on the other, whatever your take your pick, continue to leak. And will there be these continual, you know, explosions that push the agenda off the tracks? We don't know, but the conflict is set up there.
And Tom,
John,
related point is that the things that we're talking about, reforming the healthcare system, reforming the tax system, are extremely difficult even in good times. They require strong presidential leadership to get through the political obstacles that surface whenever you try to do something affecting large swaths of American life. And so the idea that the Trump White House is going to be able to provide that strong leadership is not looking like a very good bet at this moment.
And Kathy Gilson, and another item on President Trump's agenda, if not on the congressional agenda, is doing something about cybersecurity. He signed an executive order to beef up cybersecurity. Meanwhile, a reminder of how vulnerable this country is, a huge ransomware attack across the whole world that really underscored how the stakes in cyber warfare have changed.
Yes, and particularly have changed in terms of the ability of the NSA, for example, to keep its own cyber tools safe. I think the dilemma here is that you want the cybersecurity community to be developing these capabilities to be able to use, you know, to say hypothetically sabotage a nuclear program of a rogue state. On the other hand, that in developing these tools, to the extent that the organizations developing themselves have not taken care of their cybersecurity, you do open yourself up to the vulnerability that these things will leak and then be used against you, as apparently happened here. There seemed to be some kind of an insider leak, and we don't know who exactly. I haven't seen the latest reporting on this. I think we suspect that the shadow brokers, this organization that stole these tools and repurposed them, was behind this attack. Some reporting has suggested North Korea. Maybe you guys are more up to date on that than I am. But the dilemma remains the same. You want these capabilities, and in developing them, you raise the risk that they will fall into the wrong hands.
Well, John Harwood, there have been some reports that the pattern of the attack suggests perhaps that North Korea might have been the culprit.
That's right. And again, that underscores the need for the administration, which, by the way, has not filled out the top ranks of its administration with appointees in most departments, including the State Department, needs to get its arms around the situation.
And President Trump, as all this stuff swirls around his White House back in Washington, is off today on a 9-day trip to Europe and to the Middle East. Who knows where we'll be next week at this time. John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC, Kathy Gilsonen, senior editor at The Atlantic, and our on-point analyst, Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We say goodbye today to our hardworking digital producer, Nick Anderson, who for the past 3.5 years has been growing our On Point community of listeners online. Nick will be missed for keeping us on top of the news reliably the minute a story breaks, and we wish him all the best. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. I'm thanking our guests today. This is On Point. Thank you.